Oh, I spent it. This is Mae Bressel, and now we'll continue part two. This is broadcast number 638. That's a lot, 638, February 27th, 1984. We get one extra day this year with leap year, so we're lucky. I don't know how we squeeze that in, but we have an extra 24 hours if we're in a hurry. Now, going to the news in Los Angeles that I've gotten some calls about. I was away most of the week. In fact, I was down in Los Angeles. I went to see Johnny Meyer, the L.A. County Jail, and next week I'll do some more on that broadcast with you. I want to write a letter about his case and send it to the proper officials and then share more information with you. I've talked about Johnny. He worked for Howard Hughes' organization from 1966 to 72, and I was able to see him. Art Kunkin from, he's working with Larry Flynt, as I say, went down with me and an attorney, and we spent time with Johnny, and I'll tell you about it next week. While I was down there that Friday, there was that shootout at the old corral at the school where children were attending, and a member, former member of Jonestown, had a shootout. Just the day before that shootout, there was an article about Jonestown 2 days before, one in the New York Times and one in the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. The New York Times story says, judge sets the trial date for Guyana slaying. And the judge in San Francisco, February 23rd, the federal judge set the date of September the 4th for the retrial of Larry Layton. Larry Layton is a precious, little rich, spoiled brat whose mother gave thousands of dollars to Jim Jones, whose sister was active with Jim Jones in Jonestown, whose father was the chief of biological and chemical warfare in Southeast Asia and also at the Proving Grounds in Utah, an expert in chemical warfare, and there are suggestions that the chemicals could have been used on these people down in Jonestown. This trial, he got off once, Larry Layton did. Now there's going to be a new trial on the charges that he was responsible and knew what he was doing when he shot Congressman Leo Ryan down there. There's a charge of conspiracy to shoot Leo Ryan. I imagine it'll be a quick prosecution like the Dan White, because if the prosecution doesn't present the evidence, then the person gets off if you get a weak prosecution. And Dr. Layton is very important in the Defense Department, and I don't think the children of the rich have to go to jail, and they're coddled. Goodness knows they're coddled. They probably counted on that. Now, this story was in the New York Times on February 24th, and it was on February 24th that afternoon that the shootout took place in Los Angeles. Another story that I referred to, the article, Jonestown's last day, the tapes were played in court. The chilling last hours of Jim Jones ordering the people to drink the cyanide was played in a San Francisco court as a federal judge wants to determine if it can be used in the retrial of the case of Larry Layton. And he tells the people, for goodness sakes, let's get on with it. Take your poison. You'll have no problem. Just relax. And they're all screaming. And he's telling them over and over, just get it done. Go on through and take it and so forth. And I guess those tapes are pretty dramatic. And in the course of listening to this, they said that the prosecution, U.S. attorney Joseph Russaniello, wants to use the tapes to prove that Layton was a willing conspirator who executed the congressman and members of his party. It's spelled R-U-S-S-O-N-I-E-L-L-O, said there was a concerted effort by members, all members of Jonestown, including Jones and Layton, to prevent the truth about Jonestown from being discovered. Well, there was a concerted effort to keep that truth out then, and there's a concerted effort now, and that was one of the big objections I had to Jimmy Carter when he was running for president, is the way he kept the lid on the Jonestown information. Now, the Los Angeles Herald, February 25th, one day later, has the story about the shootout down in Los Angeles. Titled Jonestown Survivor Kills One, Wounds 13, and Shoots Himself. That's the Los Angeles Herald. That's February 25th, 1984. And this is just a day after the decision of the federal judge that they would reopen the trial in San Francisco. Now, at the time of the Grenada invasion, there were news accounts that Guyana, that Burnham in Guyana knew in advance that America was going to invade at that time into Grenada several days in advance. They had word that this was going to happen. And the night before the invasion into Grenada, two members of Jonestown that worked in Washington, D.C. and were familiar with the people involved with the Grenada invasion both died. It was a murder-suicide. And I mentioned that on the air, that the Grenada invasion could be linked to the Jonestown operation. And, of course, I'm writing a lot about that. I've done a lot of research on it. Now, this particular fellow who shot at the schoolyard and then killed himself, Tyrone Mitchell, his mother and father and four sisters died at Jonestown. And he survived. There was a question, a discrepancy of where he was, whether he was sick, whether he was at the dentist, and so forth. But Tyrone lived directly across the street from the 49th Street School. He lived directly facing the schoolyard. This is a history from Jonestown. His home used to be where the school was, and it was torn down. His home was torn down. The school was built. And he rented an apartment, 732 East 50th Street, that looked from his window right to a schoolyard after the trauma of being in a place where 912 people are killed, including the children, the massive number of children, and your own siblings, and your own brothers, sisters, and your parents. He faced the schoolyard. Now, according to all the newspaper accounts so far, the police knew he was on drugs. They knew that he took PCP, that he was a regular user. They didn't stop. I thought drugs were illegal. They didn't stop him. They knew he was deeply disturbed. The police knew he had weapons. He had AR-15 semi-automatic rifles, two of them. He had several double-barreled shotguns, pump-action guns. He had an arsenal in the house of 180 rounds of ammunition that he had to buy somewhere. Here's a guy who's off his head, takes drugs. He's out of the Jonestown milieu, and there were references that after Jonestown of 147 trained assassins that were out loose in society at the time. He jammed his rifle after 39 rapid-fire shots. He had dozens of live shotgun shells in the house. He was going to be... there was a complaint against him 2 weeks earlier, and the police did nothing about that. A relative thought that he may be cooking up something or shooting somebody. They had an altercation. The minute that he was shot, the police said, the very first day, this is in the Los Angeles Herald and Examiner, the police are ready to wrap up the investigation. We're not interested in why he did it, Detective Steve Morgan said. Only one person knows, and he's dead. And they asked what set it off, and he said, that's going to be the bottom of our agenda. He's dead. This is an open and shut case. In other words, the San Francisco trial, or getting word to appear, or somebody seeing him before he goes crazy, or phone calls such as George de Morenchild got the morning that he allegedly shot himself. He has lunch with Edward Epstein of the CIA, a provocateur writer. And then he's supposed to meet a member of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and he is dead that same day, a primary witness to the John Kennedy assassination, probably the most important witness, dies the afternoon he's to be questioned. And this Tyrone Mitchell had testified against Larry Layton before, so he could be called as a witness in San Francisco. The relatives said, we're not surprised about the shooting. We heard he was into drugs. He drinks a lot. He flips out now and then. He slices people's tires. The police know about him. They know about the firearms. This nearby Newton station, where the police station is nearby, knows about him. The uncle complained about the guns. When there's airplanes in the sky, helicopters, he's shooting up in the air. He has no job. Where is he getting the ammunition shooting? You know, they're near L.A. Airport. That's a lot of planes to go by to be shooting all those airplanes and ammunition. You still have to buy the stuff. So Mitchell did have a short police record before Jonestown and afterwards. And where he was is open to a lot of contradiction. How he survived it is open to contradiction. Now, very interestingly, he had an attorney in San Francisco. He was the client of Marcus Topel, T-O-P-E-L. a Bay Area lawyer, and while the police were having this altercation, the SWAT teams in Los Angeles, they were on the telephone with his attorney in San Francisco while this is going on, which means that the Bay Area was in touch with the law enforcement down in L.A. How would you, at that moment when you're shooting all these things at school children directly across the street, be able to just conveniently get his attorney on the telephone? This is exactly what happened when the SLA was formed by the Los Angeles Police Department, as was Jonestown, and a big hunk of Jonestown with the LAPD and Stanford Institute working together on a CIA operation. Donald DeFries comes down to the Los Angeles area from San Francisco and has five other members of the SLA with him. There were six. He was telephonically in touch with a member of the Los Angeles Police Department up to 1 hour before they were all burned to death inside that house. So that the LAPD was in touch with Donald DeFries, and the LAPD and the SWAT team were in touch with Tyrone Mitchell's attorney in the Bay Area while this was going on. And according to this article, this is the San Francisco Chronicle, February 26, Mitchell used Topol as his attorney when the grand jury was investigating People's Temple, and that he had testified about the investigation of the assassination of Representative Leo Ryan. Now, a day before all the shootout happened, it was in the paper, and also I imagine he knew that Larry Layton would be tried again. He also was one of the 17 survivors that was flown into New York from Guyana on December the 7th, 1978. If you go way back to broadcast 373, I talked about those 17 defectors who flew into Miami and New York that were met by CIA agent John Blatchford. Central Intelligence Agency met the 17. He was one of those 17 who worked with the CIA. He has an attorney in San Francisco where he testified about Larry Layton. The Larry Layton case is opening up again. And now Tyrone Mitchell, one of the few survivors around, is gone. Dr. Hardat Sucato, maybe you remember him from the Jonestown investigation or the hearings. Hardat, H-A-R-D-A-T, and his last name is S-U-K-H-D-E-O. He was originally from India, and he was living in Georgetown at the time of the Guyana massacre. And he was the one that went in there that said the people had been shot and murdered, that they didn't all take suicide. And he was a doctor who gave a sort of a dissenting opinion about the way they died. Well, they quoted him with regards to Mitchell in the newspaper this week, but they referred to him as a professor of psychiatry at the University of New Jersey Medical School in Newark, New Jersey. And I wonder if he had any of those medical school students that went to New Jersey, run by psychiatrist Dr. Peter Byrne and Jeffrey Byrne at the time of the Grenada invasion. Dr. Sucato was saying that he counseled people who had problems, psychiatric problems. He had spoken to over 100 of them, and he said they had been brainwashed by Jones, and he still believed society was hostile to them. And then a Lowell Stryker, S-T-R-E-I-K-E-R, who's in Burlingame, California, director of the Freedom Counseling Center, counseled people who were specifically programmed to kill. And the survivors, many of them, had been programmed to murder. So if you need a shootout in Los Angeles, if you have a trial coming up, if the SWAT team wants to get in action to prove that there's terrorists or crazy people in Los Angeles with the Olympic Games, it's a perfect time to do it. The timing seems to be whenever there's a lull in the news. I mean, Lebanon's over, so you have to bring something on, and tomorrow it'll be another case. They'll find another Barney Clark with a heart we can all start praying for. I've watched the news segments. If you watch how they go, they have one crisis of a terrorist somewhere that covers the news one night. They have one weather problem, whether it's some kind of a hurricane or a flood or freezing in a particular place. One health condition, you've got to pray and work for somebody to pull through, and you get a health condition. And so you have one country that you're watching. Now the Lebanon and Grenada are over. They'll get down to, I guess, Nicaragua and start pushing down there. The news is broken into segments. And so we had our terrorism in L.A. That was Tyrone Mitchell. He had links with the CIA. Oh, when he did this shooting, interestingly enough, to show you how Jim Jones trained them. And the point is that they let him live across the school. They let him shoot. They let him buy the guns and ammunition. He didn't just go out as a person who grabbed a gun and offed those kids. He put himself in full regalia of his military clothes. The newspaper described he had his army camouflage pants. He had brown and black combat boots. He put on his khaki security guard shirt with a badge pinned to its pocket. Where was he a security guard, for gosh sakes? He dresses up, and then he takes out these huge arsenals of weapons and shoots one child. Some are in still critical condition. And then shoots himself, goes out with a bang. This is some kind of a program zombie who not only didn't get over the tragedy of Jonestown, but should have been relocated away from small children after all those other children died that he knew, should have certainly not been across from a school, should not have been around the corner from a police station that knew he was on drugs, that knew he was shooting, that had complaints about his shooting, should not have been provided weapons and arsenals, was not programmed if he was a killer or deprogrammed as this psychologist in Burlingame is supposed to be doing. Here was a living time bomb that the news media loves, that the police department plays with, just like the Donald DeFries who's involved with crimes in L.A. and they say, wait, we'll send you to this mental place and we'll send you to Vacaville. And then they begin introducing people to him, college graduates like Emily and William Harris and Angela and Gary Atwood from the narc squads from Indiana, teasing him and telling him he'll be a great leader and bending his mind and pulling off this great Patty Hearst story described in People magazine. Their anniversary is one of the 10 best stories of the past 10 years, the Patty Hearst case. Human tragedy, playing with what people will do, what people will believe, killing people right on camera, watching them burn. Whether it's the Jonestown SWAT down in Guyana or the SWAT team in L.A., the SLA, playing with human lives, eventually, this is going to rub all of us closer at home. The karma is going to come back if you sit and take this, if you like this, if you accept this as normal behavior in our society where the crazies, the government agencies, are running the show, then you're in deep trouble. Now, what is the solution? In the 10 minutes I have left, or 12 minutes, I'm going to discuss a major victory. This is a victory of some sorts in Los Angeles, and it is not over yet, and it has to do with the Los Angeles Police Department and the settlement of the case last week, which is terribly important. Now, that complicated Los Angeles police story that I've been carrying is a three-part story, and I may jump in the weeks to come to part one, part two, part three, or interweave them. But there are three parts of that story that we've been carrying for the past year that are terribly important. The first has to do with a five-year lawsuit of the American Civil Liberties Union representing 133 to 140 plaintiffs against the Los Angeles police spying on them illegally on law-abiding citizens. Now, that case was going up 5 years until they were ready to look for certain documents to proceed as of May last year when they discovered them in the, a lot of these documents were taken home by Jay Paul. And the second part of the story has to Western Goals and the Los Angeles Police Department because the computer that was put in by the chairman of the John Birch Society, Larry McDonald, and the U.S. military with former Chief of Staff Admiral Moore and mobsters like Roy Cohn and members of the Galen operation and Steinles from the Luftwaffe, Nazi CIA, Pentagon, Birch Society, Murder Incorporated, Western Goals computer to put this information into it. And that, starting in May, complicated the case no end and probably was part of the reason of settling the case right now, although the Western Goals part is proceeding and will continue. And the third part has to do with the Olympic Games coming to Los Angeles this summer, and Western Goals computers for that purpose, and the Los Angeles Police Department. But this past week, the case was settled. Now, just before we go into the terms of the settlement, well, I'll pass this other article and get back to that next week. I do want to get the terms of the settlement out for you. There were several articles in the LA Times and the LA Herald that never made the wire services, and then one finally in the New York Times. The first story said all spies sued plaintiffs, but one accepted the settlement. They all agreed up to 144 plaintiffs. One gentleman, Ron Jones, is missing. They haven't seen him for 2 years, and he's holding up the settlement unless they'll decide in the next few days what to do. The Los Angeles City Council agreed to settle for $1.8 million, the largest settlement of any police department in the United States. $900,000 will go to the ACLU attorneys. There's 20 of them. And they're going to take $100,000 to begin other lawsuits against the sheriff's department and the FBI, which is a good starter. They can start with Peter Pitches and the Manson family and the Isla Vista if they want a good starter. But I can supply a lot of information if they want to get on that. But $900,000 for the attorneys, $900,000 for the plaintiffs. One is missing. They haven't seen him in several years. Now, the media broke the story finally by putting it in the New York Times. This case has gone on for 5 years. Can you imagine that the UPI, when the case is over, did mention Western Goals? It did mention J. Paul. Just briefly, they didn't identify what Western Goals is, and they didn't identify the Birch Society, but none of the wire services, Reuters, AP, UPI, covered this case at all, with just a couple of single stories coming out. But the settlement is the interesting part, and this shows what people will do if they get together and can do something. This case began as a small case for the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker group, who realized that they were being spied upon and their names were in files of the police department. They cannot commit a crime. They teamed up with the ACLU, the American Friends. This goes back 5 years ago, and the ACLU said, "We'll help you." And they created the Southern California Network Against Government Spying. Then it became the Citizens Commission on Police Repression, headed by Linda Valentina, with a coalition of 43 different civil liberty groups. They filed a suit in 1978, and it kept growing until the police department finally made a settlement. Now, the terms of the settlement are very interesting, and this is what they decreed, if I can put it in the next 8 minutes, because this is a handful, the American Indians, the Black Panthers, the Chicano group, the United Farm Workers, a group of separate people who individually had nothing, who pooled their resources and not only got to a chance to expose for 5 years parts of the police department, but got an agreement. They don't want to go to trial. The police department is scared. The city council is scared. So they made a settlement, and these are some of the terms. The Los Angeles City Council must be responsible for making the anti-terrorist group operate within the rules. They made an agreement with a new set of standards for the ATC, that's the Anti-Terrorist Division. These are the same people from the PDID, that's Public Disorder Intelligence Division. They changed their name. The City Council must be responsible for making the anti-terrorists operate within the City Council rules. The Council will designate a special committee who are to examine all of their performances and they're to review the Police Commission's annual audit of the division. The Council will hold public meetings to allow citizens in Los Angeles or elsewhere to comment on the anti-terrorist division if they're overstepping their boundary, which is just wonderful. The PDID was abolished when they found that J. Paul was working with Larry McDonald. And the other terms are that the police commission has to review the operations of Los Angeles Police Department's Organized Crime Intelligence Division as well, the OCID. They'll watch the ATD Anti-Terrorist Division, and they have access to the OCID, which is the Organized Crime Intelligence Division. The ACLU and other forces will watch it, and they agreed not to interfere with them until January 30th, 1985. The police commission must come up with any guidelines needed to govern the city of Los Angeles and the police department. The ACLU, under settlement, by not going to court on this, promised not to file lawsuits against the Organized Crime Division for 10 months. If they find anything wrong, they have to wait 10 months for the settlement, which seems fair enough in this case. They can do their work. The ACLU lawyer Paul Hoffman said that $100,000 of the share would be used to establish the ACLU police Practice Litigation Fund. The money will hire lawyers to monitor the compliance with the settlement and explore bringing other police buying lawsuits against the county sheriff and the FBI. They have other conditions. We'll go in them. The decree leaves Los Angeles, according to the LA Times, with the toughest police spy rules nationally in the entire country. These are the toughest rules. The consent decree ended the suit, but it established the controls totally. The civil liberty groups will curb political spying by national police and municipal police departments because the idea of the lawsuits has been spreading it around, and they do have lawsuits in other cities that weren't as strong but can get stronger. What emerged, the articles about this said, was a string of civil lawsuits that produced revelations from the 1960s and 1970s by local police forces similar to the FBI. Now, the additional protection is that there will be civilian authority to approve or reject their undercover operations. They can't have them without civilian authority. Now it will be important for the LA citizens to vote in a good city council. Two members of the police commission, they oversee the Los Angeles Police Department, will authorize if police surveillance is necessary. And if it's not, they can't have it. Two members of the commission will periodically audit their financial records to see where the money is going and what goes out. The city council will be apprised every year of intelligence activities of the police department. Now remember, the sheriff and the FBI can get in on the next suit. The accord spells out in detailed terms that any evidence that they have to begin spying on a person or an organization, it is necessary to produce that evidence and show them if they want to start or continue a probe spying. These are law-abiding citizens. There must be a written record of everybody who has a hand in any investigation. If you are spying on me or somebody else, you have to have a written approval. You can't wiretap them, you can't photograph them, you can't put them in the file. If you sign an anti-war petition down there, you can't go into Admiral Moore's computer, and they will keep track of who passes on information. And there must be a public disclosure of the number of authorized investigations. They have to make that public. The court will retain this jurisdiction over the settlement agreement until 1991, that's 7 years, so that the ACLU can seek an injunction against the police for violations of the accord. They have access to intelligence files if people complain that their name is in a file. If through freedom of information it is still there and they continue an active file, they have to explain why. And for 9 years of watching them, they may lose their bad habits because it will be hard to have these Lewis Tackwoods hired and earning salary to bring drugs into the black community or setting up a band to go to San Quentin so a certain DA can be elected from the valley. The salaries for these covert operations will be watched. The operations will be watched. They have to have approval. So with the city council and the police commission, it looks like this will be the best control of any police department in the United States. Now, it's only righteous that it should happen there because it's also the worst police department in the United States. Out of there, we created the situation for Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, for the drugging and kidnapping of Howard Hughes, for the Bobby Hall murder, the Manson family, the Isla Vista riots, the killing of the Chicanos, and even the plans to kill Cesar Chavez, and the Black Death Squads, and the murders of various stars, and drug people, you know, like being drugged like John Belushi, the coroner's office and provocateurs being hired for these various crimes, and then handing it on to the Defense Department. This state is a terror organization run by, he's now a senator, Ed Davis, and Daryl Gates of the LAPD, who was in the Marines, and the whole counterintelligence operation of James McCord and E. Howard Hunt, who treated California as if it were Guatemala or Uruguay or Chile, and now there are controls. They were bad people, and they don't want to go to court. They say it would be too costly and it would be too long. But they don't want the dirt of the 60s and 70s in court. As I said before, Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, the attorney for Ronald Reagan's office and the office of the Attorney General, John Mitchell, wanted to opt for not going to court. They'd rather pay $1.5 million to these poor plaintiffs. They were poor people. There's no famous person among them. Each of them will get $5,000 or $6,000 for getting their names into computers and being followed and photographed. And this is a case where a lot of poor people individually got behind an organization and it worked. So if you sound dismal or depressed, just remember that when you get your energy together, it happens. And now in Los Angeles and hopefully in other cities, you'll have more security because a few people did a lot of hard work for 5 years. Well, that is the end of this hour. It goes by pretty fast. It's Mae Brussel. I'll be back with you next week. You take care of yourselves. This is KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California.